Obama was a threat, and they absolutely had their eye on him. They were worried about him. And, of course, by the summer, late summer, early fall, it was clear that Obama was the favorite, and John McCain was not going to be able to beat him. And so that, in the end, played a very important role in negotiations.
Well, stand by, gentlemen. We've got a full house here today. Sorry to cut off Gareth Porter. His articles should be up at MERIP, M-E-R-I-P, Middle East Research and Information Project, where he's a fellow now. He's also at Alternet. That was most of the interview with the program out of KPFT. That's the Houston Pacifica station. Opinions of those of the speakers, not necessarily shared, et cetera, et cetera. And let's kick off the Labor Hour. Better New Year. Happy might be a little to shoot for.
We'll try.
Okay. We'll be right back.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the December 31st, 2011 New Year's Eve edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at WFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour program and those of the speaker do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed or underemployed helpline, call area code 217-469-6111. And this hour of programming is brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas. We'll have some workers' interest news for us, and later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's brand new poem for this week is entitled Together Shore to Shore, and you'll hear it first here on the Illinois World Labor Hour. Also here with us today is Jason Kozlowski, visiting us from Florida, co-host Bob Pelesny, and co-host and founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorell. Now, here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of some workers' interest news. Now, what we're going to do, folks, is since this is our New Year's Eve show, we're going to basically kind of recap the year here. So I think, Tom, do you have anything story for January? Or?
No, I didn't.
Okay, we're going to go probably month to month here. So I guess I'll start out because I got a story in January that, you know,
first was August.
Okay. But what's interesting is that I look back with all my files on the, you know, in my PC at home, looking at the news stories I'd saved over the course of the year for the show. And man, oh man, people, I'll tell you what, 2011 was one heck of a year. A lot happened. And got some interesting, just to start off here, we got some interesting anniversaries in 2011. First of all, 2011 was the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, which happened on March 25th, 1911, in which 146 Jewish and Italian immigrant women burned to death in a fire, a factory fire, and which shouldn't have happened. I mean, the problem was they couldn't get out once the fire started because all the doors were locked, because the employers locked the women in because they were afraid that they might go take breaks or something. And what's really, you know, insidious about this is I saw some footage from Bangladesh or Indonesia about a year ago in which there was a factory fire there in a garment factory. And I tell you what, it looked, I mean, so much reminiscent of the footage and photos from the, you know, the factory, shirtwaist factory fire in New York City in 1911. Also, it's a 50th anniversary of Dwight D. Eisenhower's, President Dwight Eisenhower's last speech as president on January 17, 1961, in which he warned about the military-industrial complex.
Beware of the military-industrial complex.
Indeed.
That's what he had to say.
Indeed. And it also, 2011 was the 100th birthday of Ronald Reagan, the 40th president of the United States, and who basically started our current 30-year decline economically. And, you know, it's amazing. You know, his presidency, they're trying to, you know, what I was surprised about is they didn't make more of a hoopla about his 100th birthday this year in 2011, because I was expecting a lot of that. And we got to remember, folks, that not just the current economic decline, how he started changing things institutionally, but also in his term as president, there were 14 indictments and 11 convictions because of the Iran-Contra affair, which a lot of people have forgotten about, not to mention his funding of terrorists in Central America. And frankly, a lot of people in his administration could be considered guilty of war crimes.
Yeah, you should read sometime read his autobiography if you want something to put you to sleep at night. It's called Where's the Rest of Me?
Where's the Rest of Me?
Okay. Yeah, and the story behind that was he was playing the Gipper. You know, his famous role is the Gipper.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Gipper is disabled. I don't know if he got his legs cut off or what, but the whole idea was that he was to wake up in this role, you know, at some certain point in the movie, and then wonder and act like he's wondering, where is the rest of me?
Oh, okay.
But it is, I tell you, Matt, it was one of the most boring books I have ever read in my life. I read it about 15 years ago.
Oh, wow.
It's awful.
Mm, man. Well, to start off the year, as far as our news stories, in January, the San Francisco Labor Council declared its firm opposition to the efforts of the U.S. and other governments and corporations to criminalize, financially destroy, and shut down WikiLeaks, and to silence and jail and prosecute Julian Assange as well as Bradley Manning. You know, this is a story that I'd forgotten all about. Anyway, I guess the resolution, it ended by saying it be finally resolved. The council will send a letter to our congressional representatives in both U.S. senators to make them aware of our position and to call for them to join us in opposing the persecution of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and Bradley Manning. And the council will also request that the International Red Cross conduct an investigation into how Bradley Manning is being treated while incarcerated. This was submitted on January 10th, 2011. So, January, what else happened in January? Anybody else? I know, I think that's about the time that the Tunisian and Egyptian revolts, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I don't know, man, but I probably shouldn't be going by a month-by-month basis. I would say that a really big thing was the Arab Spring, and then later on the Madison Spring. And then, you know, the Occupy movement.
Well, we're going to be covering all that, Bill.
Yeah, I know, but uh-huh. I feel
as far as a synopsis, yes, that's a good point. Yeah,
I mean,
what
month
you're saying.
By month, it's going to be, I can't think of everything. I can't remember the company now, down in Metropolis in Illinois.
We got some of that too, yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Honeywell.
Yes. Honeywell, yes. For some reason, I was thinking Johnson Controls, but they're more in Chicago. I think the Arab Spring was a really huge thing, and of course that started out. There had been a lot of dissension within the working class in Egypt for actually a few years now.
Yes,
that's not reported. The only thing that you think is going on in the Middle East is oil and Israeli-Palestinian stuff, and even in Israel,
mm-hmm.
there is a lot of working of labor activism and strikes and everything else. It's not just about the Palestinians there.
Yes.
And, of course, the Palestinians, well, they can't do anything, so they don't have an opportunity to strike because Israel is basically starving them out.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Of all materials, they can't even get cement there because it supposedly could be used to build walls or something to keep the Israelis out. I don't know.
Oh, man.
But I think that was a very important thing, and I think it opened a lot of people's eyes up around the world. And then there was also the earlier, this was pre 2011, but the riots in England.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got
last fall.
Yes,
I mean around a year ago. I don't know. Maybe people are finally waking up, and this is maybe. I hope it's snowballing.
Oh, I hope so, too. I think 2012 is going to be another interesting year. So no one else has anything in January, I guess. Jason? Tom, sure you.
I'm not sure if this is something that Tom had, but one of the things that we had talked about, and I was pleasantly reminded of with the copy of which that Bob had given me before, is it was when some of the things with Jimmy Johns had come to a head as far as his statements as wanting to, or feeling as though he's being pushed, Jimmy John Leotard was being pushed out of the area because of the alleged onerous tax issues locally, but also his making these statements about his alleged munificence in the community. But also, not to be forgotten in that, is the charges against Jimmy Johns for interfering with the elections with the IWW up in mm-hmm. Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So that was when many of these things were coming to a head, and some of the stuff, especially with the labor issues elsewhere, were not covered locally that other than with us.
Oh, indeed, indeed. So any takers on January? If not, we'll move on to February. Anyone have any incident event that happened in February? I have one here it was actually a local story. It was about when the Indiana Democratic legislators fled Indiana and came to Urbana, Illinois for refuge. Basically, what that was all about was that the Indiana Republican governor and the majority legislators were trying to ram through, by very anti-democratic means, some anti-union legislation.
Yeah, that's right. And it was occurring at the same time that really early in the month, but especially in the middle of the month, it was right around Valentine's Day, was when everything really got quickly heated up in Madison. Mm-hmm. That it was smack in the middle of the month, and then in conjunction with these other efforts, including in Ohio, which I'll talk about this story later, was defeated by the bill. But yes, Tennessee as well was absolutely when these anti-union issues converged. And I'm proud to say the union I belong to, the GEO, was heavily involved in not just hosting these events with the Indiana legislatures, but people going up. We had Leighton Christensen on the show who was there, but these incredibly intense and inspiring events up in Madison in the middle of the month that Bill, I think, rightly connects as far as with a Madison Spring, and that were quite consciously connected with what was going on overseas. So that seemed to get much of 2011 propelled.
Yes. I mean, so you think about it, 2011 really started off with quite a bang. I mean, both internationally as well as nationally here. I mean, just to summarize, the Arab Spring were the revolts in Tunisia and Egypt for democracy, which is still ongoing, especially in Egypt. They still haven't won. That's still ongoing. Then we had, the Madison, Wisconsin, and Indiana stuff going on, all the anti-union legislation that was being passed. And also, there were some ominous things happening in Michigan with this new law that the governor rammed through, another Republican, about where it would enable him as governor to basically nullify elections in various towns or cities and appoint his own people to run the city. I mean, think about that. Basically, pushing out people that were elected by the populations of these towns and the governor appointing somebody to run the city. I mean, you talk about a dictatorship.
Yeah, and all of these people were inherently business leaders, all corporate friendly. It was all a matter of abrogating union contracts, and especially, as you mentioned well a couple of weeks ago, I think, Dave, this was especially prominent in Benton Harbor and a lot of these especially prominent African-American places and places where these communities were already gutted that the solution was relieving their votes and also first and foremost was getting rid of union contracts and basically having dictatorship by business.
Mm-hmm. So February, anyone have anything on February? Jason, did you have a more detailed report about the whole Wisconsin thing?
Well, I did not have one necessarily drafted, but drawing back on what we had talked about so much, that it was these anti-union proposals, and it was different in Wisconsin than in other places such as with Ohio, where it had included these public, a whole range of public sector workers, you know, including firefighters and police officers and others, and the means by which they did it. That is, it wasn't just the heinousness of trying to ram this through, but also doing so, as was ruled by their court, illegally, of breaching these open hearings rules that had brought so many people there to witness this and to protest against it, that it goes to show how unpopular it was that they had to do this by the back door, and that very quickly, within a week, you had thousands of people occupying and being around the Capitol that drew an enormous amount of support from people within the region. And I think didn't draw enough as far as for organized labor, but was absolutely the touchstone for activism for the rest of the year in the United States.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that many of the things instituted in Ohio were later turned down in the election in November.
Mm-hmm.
People actually got out there and voted against some of these very proposals that had been rammed through, the anti-union proposals. Mm-hmm. So the voters actually did step up and say that they disagreed with what the executives are trying to force down their throats.
Okay. And what about March? Do we have anything for March?
No, my first one's from April.
From April? Anyone else have something in March? If not, Tom, what do you have for April?
Well, in April 2011, it was just another day for the nation's major corporations that didn't pay a penny in federal taxes, even though they may have had a highly profitable year. Take General Electric Corporation. It earned $14,200,000,000 in profits in 2010. But for the second year in a row, it paid no federal taxes. GE actually got a $3.2 billion in tax benefits by having its lawyers exploit loopholes in the tax code. Bank of America received a $1.9 billion tax refund from the IRS last year, although it made $4.4 billion in profits and received a bailout from the Federal Reserve and Treasury Department of nearly $1 trillion. For your information, 28% of large corporations, that's better than a quarter, dodge federal taxes entirely every year.
You say that like it's a bad thing, Tom. Yeah, I'm being completely sarcastic, of course.
Okay.
The views and opinions expressed are strictly those of us speakers.
Yes, indeed. And so, I mean, you know, it's kind of hard a lot of times to do this chronologically. And frankly, I did this because just when I was organizing my stories and stuff, just as a kind of a reflex and stuff. But, you know, as we noticed, there's a lot of overlaps and stuff that started at a particular point in time in 2011, but then continued on and everything. But, well, whatever. Just whatever we got. I mean, I don't know how else to do it, frankly. But is there anything going on in April besides that information Tom mentioned about the corporations? Because if not, I've got something in May here, unless Bill's got something.
Well, I don't have anything from any particular time, but okay. I do have a nomination for Person of the Year.
Oh, okay.
And that is the... And this is from a story from the website The Raw Story, and the headline is Japanese Firm Creates Humanoid Robot to Replace Factory Workers.
Oh, okay.
So, anyway, this robot, it's from the Japanese firm Kawada Industries, and it's called Next Stage. And I nominate it for Humanoid of the Year, and hopefully someday there will be some robotic means to replace all labor. And that the fruits of that labor will be shared by people,
yeah,
not corporations or just capitalist owners.
Yes, that's the problem, though. You know,
we get these robotic laborers to do all these things for us, and then we can create art and sell it to each other.
Okay. Well, I know in May.
And by the way, along lines of that, mm-hmm. people might want to check out the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. Because that is one of their driving ideas. And it's actually old. It goes back to Marx.
Yeah.
Karl Marx, that was his idea, was that all labor would eventually be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have a utopia. But the League of Revolutionaries are into that idea. And that's you have some interesting ideas that you might want to check out. That's lrna.org.
Okay. Well, in May, May of 2011, a bill to provide health care coverage for all Americans through a federal single-payer system was introduced in Congress by Senator Bernie Sanders, independent socialist senator from Vermont, and Representative Jim McDermott, a Democrat of Washington. It went to state that of the industrialized nations, only the United States does not have a national system of health care for their citizens, that is Medicare for all. And under this bill, known as the Health Security Act, the federal government would set a basic framework for the system, including national standards on benefits, quality, and access to care. But the problem was it was defeated with half of the Democrats in the Congress voting against the bill, along with all the Republicans. Later in that year, Vermont passed a state bill, basically enacting a single-payer system. But the problem with that bill is now they've got to fight the federal government to enact it because part of the Obama health care bill prohibited individual states from enacting their own individual health care, single-payer health care systems till 2014.
Right. I remember that. And without wanting to mismatch chronology too much, but this story, when you'd sort of flagged it, reminded me of something else in March, which was the removal of the mural from Maine.
Oh, yes.
That the governor had said and then went back later and tried to lie about it.
Mm-hmm. The mural, it was a labor mural, right?
That's right. It was a labor mural, and it was something that it was in a section in the Department of Labor that was also honoring local residents like Francis Perkins and others, but depicted interesting things like child labor, which was in Maine something that the governor was trying to push for. So it overlapped with other anti-union and not labor-friendly issues at the time, but that was definitely something in March.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, by the way, I guess we're fortunate in Illinois that we didn't get one of these reactionary anti-labor Republicans like the governor of Maine, because they would have had to repaint the entire top of the rotunda.
In Springfield?
Yes, in Springfield. If you look up there, and sorry, it is a whole bunch of white guys doing various tasks on the ceiling. I can't remember what they all are. I know there's one like farming and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I tell you. So anyway, moving on then. Let's see, May. Anything else in May? If not, anything in June that was interesting?
I've got a little something in June here about Jimmy John's.
Oh, okay.
Hey, in June of 2011, it was revealed that 2 months after Jimmy John's fired six workers for blowing the whistle on a company practice of forcing sandwich makers to work while sick, the IWW, Jimmy John's Workers Union, had released Minnesota Department of Health documents revealing 8 outbreaks of foodborne illnesses at franchises across the Twin Cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul area in the past 5 years, 7 of which were due to employees working while sick. The release of the documents seriously erodes the credibility of the Minneapolis franchise owner, Mike Mulligan, who had previously claimed to reporters and employees that the company has made more than 6 million sandwiches during its nearly 10 years in business, and no one's ever gotten sick from eating one. 2 of the outbreaks, both caused by sick employees, were at Mulligan stores. This was a smoking gun, evidence not only of the seriousness of the public health risk caused by workers being forced to work while sick at Jimmy John's, it also proves that Jimmy John's franchise owner, Mike Mulligan, willfully lied to the media, the public, and his employees about his food safety track record.
Boy, I tell you what, Jimmy John's is just like some turd in a toilet that just keeps floating to the surface.
I noticed something on the local 703 website, and this must have been last spring too, because I don't think they've updated it since at the latest last February. And that is, there was a, the building trades in town here had a picket on Jimmy John's.
Oh, they did? Which,
Was
it the one over on Cunningham or?
I believe it was. Yeah, Bill was right, and that was going on for some time, and it was going on at the same time these other things were going on, that they wouldn't hire union people to build this.
Okay. I think John Ryman's calling in, and we'll take his call here. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, David.
Hi, John. How you doing?
Okay, how's it going with you?
Good, good. We're just kind of recapping some stories from 2011. Man, I'll tell you, 2011 was a heck of a year.
Do you want me to just hold until you're finished with that?
No. We want to immediately talk with you. And the reason, one of the reasons we had you call in today was just to kind of give us a little synopsis of what happened out in Oakland with the Occupy movement, since you were involved with it almost day one, and what you think is should be the future of the Occupy movement. If you'd like to just start wherever you want, just go ahead.
Okay. Have we got like a couple hours here?
Yeah, about 20 minutes or so, if you could do it in that time. I mean, just, you know, some highlights and some, I think, you know, I just want to remind the listeners that John Ryman was making a lot of postings, almost sometimes daily accounts of what was going on. And I just kind of was wanting him to kind of, now that the smoke has cleared a little bit, kind of call in and kind of just give it a little bit of his assessment of everything that happened.
Well, if we remember, it was just about a year ago, a little bit less than that, that you had the big movement there in Wisconsin, right?
Yes, indeed.
And then that kind of died down, and then the Occupy movement started, you know, shortly after that.
Yes, shortly after Labor Day, I believe, in New York City.
Right,
yes.
And so I think that, you know, that we can't see these two things in isolation from each other.
Yes.
Basically what it is the United States is starting to enter the 21st century.
Okay.
Where, I mean, you've seen big mass movements all over the world, in Europe, in Northern Africa, in the Arab world, and in China, of course, and that's starting to develop here. And for those of us who have been active in the labor movement for a long time, I have to say it didn't come in the way that we would have expected it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but ready or not, here it is.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, and as I think you discussed a couple weeks ago on your show, for the second time, the Occupy movement shut down the Port of Oakland a few weeks back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a great success, But there were also some things, you know, any time that you're involved in a movement like this that's really developing, there can be a tendency not to look enough at okay, what things need to be changed? What are the potential problems? Where is this thing developing? You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I think one thing with the shutdown of the Port of Oakland is that there were almost no port workers. In particular, I'm thinking of the longshore workers.
The ILWU.
There were
mm-hmm.
almost none of them directly involved in it.
Well, that's really, you know, interesting. I mean, to say the least. I mean, surprising that there were none of the actual port workers involved in it.
Well, I think it was for a couple of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, after the plans were already laid to shut the port down, the International of the Longshoremen's Union came out against it.
Okay.
And I think that the reason that they came out against it was the, you know, like the issue that's been haunting the labor movement for decades now, and that is that they see the interests of the union and of its members as being connected with and being in some ways one and the same as the interests of the employers.
Okay.
And there's always a threat, and in fact, the port did make the threat.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those shippers that utilize the Port of Oakland made the threat that if this sort of disruption continues, then we're going to take our business elsewhere to mm-hmm. a different port.
Mm-hmm. Also, there's probably threats of lawsuits against the union, basically suing them for their assets and stuff. Because
there was that, mm-hmm. but the International was a lot more decisive and harsher than they needed to be to just protect themselves from legal repercussions. It was clear they didn't want it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this then influenced the layer of the local leadership.
Okay.
And, you know, any of us that's been active in a union, we know how 99 times out of 100, the tops of the leadership of the locals listen more to what the International says than what their members want and need.
Yes.
And so I think that was the case there, too.
Okay.
So that was one reason.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, there's just been this, long-standing tendency within organized labor for the members to kind of leave things up to the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what you have a leadership for, in fact, isn't it? And it's very difficult to organize outside of the official structures and against the official structures of the leadership of the unions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what would have been required in this situation. So, and then there were even some members who were reported to have been somewhat hostile
mm-hmm.
to having to miss a day's work.
Okay. I did see a bunch of reports, too, about the truckers that were coming into the port. Of course, most of them are non-union, and both union and non-union truckers do come into the port, and both groups of people said they sympathized with the occupation movement, but they couldn't afford to miss a day's wages. That was an interesting dynamic, I thought. You know,
almost all the truckers are non-union because they're legally considered to be owner-operators. So technically, mm-hmm. they're according to the law, and it's really a fraud, but they're not employees. They own their own business.
Yes, yes.
I think, you know, a lot of the truckers were very sympathetic because they are really getting screwed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of them were quite sympathetic. But then some of them, as you say, you know, I mean, they've got their bills to pay. They're paying a note on their truck and all of that. And so some of them were at least neutral, more than that. But overall, I'd say both the truckers and the longshore workers, the majority were sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue is how long, you know, at some point you have to get the workers in the workplace to shut the workplace down themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be done for them.
Yes, yes. And inevitably what's going to happen is they're going to miss some pay. I mean, you know as well as I do the history of you know, strike action in this country is that there's been strikes sometimes that will take months, you know. sometimes right. even years, you know. And that's always, you know, a situation that, you know, the workers got to be prepared for. But, you know, the main point is that this is a decision the workers have to make themselves. So this was a really kind of a interesting dynamic here going on, you know. And I'm glad you were there to witness it and stuff and, you know, to report this. And I guess it's kind of presents both a well, kind of a problem, if you will, as far where the occupation movement should go from here.
Well, the other part is, after the general strike back in November, or right around that time, when it became clear that the Occupy movement in Oakland was not going to be going away,
mm-hmm.
and that it was going to be a significant force, at least for some time, even if it was just a matter of months, possibly longer than that,
mm-hmm.
in and around Oakland. And when that happened, a layer of the union leadership started to infiltrate, in a way, the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they did it for two reasons. One is that they had it in mind to use the Occupy movement for whatever issues, you know, they have on the plate. And most and this is connected with another thing. They wanted to try to influence the Occupy movement in such a way that it wouldn't become a threat to them.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense of that it wouldn't start to channel a layer of workers, including union members, into something more radical. And in general, I think they had that concern. But concretely, what they are thinking about is, as we know, the presidential elections
uh-huh.
next. And they wanted to see if they could, in some way, channel the Occupy movement into in some way helping the Obama campaign. And it doesn't have to be directly in terms of getting the Occupy movement to directly campaign for Obama,
mm-hmm.
although, of course, they would like that,
mm-hmm.
and they'll try to get that to some extent. But the other part is if they can turn it in the direction of campaigns that at least a layer of the Democrats, to some extent or another,
mm-hmm.
then at least to that extent it can be and limit the Occupy movement to that.
To electoral politics.
It's not even necessarily electoral politics,
mm-hmm.
but let's say, for instance, a campaign to tax the rich,
uh-huh.
But a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, that's something that the Democrats, at least a layer of the Democrats, can support. Many of them verbally, and some of them actually, they might put a bill forward or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
So then, even if the Occupy movement never directly campaigns for those Democrats, if it's limited, or at least partially limited to such campaigns, then it would just be natural for a lot of people then to make the step from there to voting for the candidates that support these issues.
Well, we kind of saw something happen in 2008. Prior to 2008, we had a really strong anti-war movement going on in this country. And then come the 2008 elections, all that energy and mobilization got sucked into the Obama campaign. So I can see that being definitely...
And Dave, I'd like to add, it's also now being sucked into the Ron Paul campaign with a lot of people.
In Iowa?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just ask Cindy Sheehan, man. All these Paulistas jump on her on her threads and Facebook because they think that she's her buddy. When actually Cindy Sheehan has gone way beyond anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, she has become one of a really good class warrior in the United States. She sees a political economy underlying all of this stuff. Sorry, John, I just wanted to jump in with
that. Oh, that's fine. I think that gets back to another issue. And I want to preface that, you know, some years ago, the Wall Street Journal had an editorial whose title was Ideas Matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's another issue that the Occupy movement has to think about a little bit more, because so far, in the main, the dominant trend has been action, 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 action.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, no movement for change in society is worth anything if there's not action and serious and radical mass action. Nobody's questioning that. But the other side is, as the Wall Street Journal says, ideas do matter. And so I think that a weakness of the Occupy movement is that it's, you know, that it doesn't hasn't really clarified a program, what we're for.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain extent, what we're against, but even not even that, not all that clearly. And so because that isn't clarified, people like the right-wing libertarians, the Ron Paulistas, and those types can come into the movement and act like we have something in common.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And as far as Ron Paul, I mean, if you look at his economic program, it's a program of finance capital.
Mm-hmm.
That would, on the one hand, would absolutely devastate the working class economically, especially poor, you know, people at the lower rungs. And on the other hand, by driving down prices, which is what it would do, it would enormously increase the value of the dollar, so that then the creditor, if somebody is owed $1,000, if the value of the dollar goes up, all of a sudden what they're owed increases.
Mm-hmm.
If you see what I'm saying.
Okay.
So that all the lenders then are paid back in dollars that are even more valuable, and the borrowers, which is the American working class, the borrowers would find it harder to get a hold of the dollars because everything, including wages, are driven down even further. So he really is like the pure essence of the interests of finance capital in America.
Okay, Jason.
Yeah, John, I mean, all this stuff is fascinating. I'm interested in seeing where you think that Occupy Wall Street, really in conjunction with a firmer class-oriented politics, but one independent of the Democratic Party, needs to go, especially given these issues and some divisions between working-class institutions and unions, but also at times I think some class divides within people who are involved in Occupy Wall Street. How is it, I guess, in essence, that where should Occupy Wall Street move forward in a way that, one, maintains political and ideological independence from these established parties, but two, also connects more strongly with class issues and maybe provides some kind of class-oriented solutions?
Well, there's a couple people out here in Occupy Oakland who've expressed the idea of what they call the propaganda of the deed. And there's a general tendency, I think, to just organize amongst the activists and we'll go out and do something and hopefully other people will follow.
Right.
And I think that, yes, we need to do that, but I don't think that's enough. And so I think one thing is we have to really systematically, consciously be organizing amongst different layers of the working class. For instance, I think it would be great to have an organizing, like a union organizing campaign aimed at fast food workers. I think that's one direction. Also, there's discussion about occupying more like foreclosed houses and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's good, but I think that we also have to get the people who are being foreclosed upon, get them involved in something like that. So that, in other words, we start to sink roots within the working, you know, in wider layers of the working class itself, and try to get workers themselves involved directly in fighting for their own interests. That's the first thing. And the other thing is, and this may be something of a heresy within the Occupy movement, but I do think that we have to reconsider our approach as far as electoral politics. And I understand that in the state of Ohio, there's an Occupy political party now that's planning to run candidates. And I think that we have to think about that because, there is a certain validity, I think, to what critics of electoral politics say, you know, that it's a it can be a diversion,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that you're not getting workers out really fighting for themselves. That's how electoral politics traditionally is in the United States. But that's because there's no mass workers' party.
Mm-hmm.
You had in the workplace, you have an organization that tries to unite all the workers to fight against the boss, and that's the union.
Mm-hmm.
But even at their height, the unions have only represented, what, about 35% of the workforce have been in unions.
That's right.
And how about all the other workers, or the unemployed, the youth, and so on? you need some kind of organization that masses of workers can get involved in. That would be a mass political party. And then you can't avoid the question then of electoral politics. And it's not like if you get some senators and congresspeople elected that they're going to solve the problems for workers. In the first place, an elected workers' representative, well, in the first place, they have to be on workers on the same wage as the average worker that they represent. But also, then, they could be like an organizing center. They can use their position to help millions of workers organize around the issues that confront us. And also, the whole aspect of electoral politics, what is it really all about, or what it should be all about, is a debate around ideas. And as I keep saying, ideas matter. And right now, all it's about is who loves their wife more, who goes to church more, who likes to kiss babies more, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but if you had real workers' leaders campaigning, then you would have a real serious debate, for instance, about American foreign policy. And what does that reflect as far as how would the American working class, what does it advocate as far as relating to the rest of the world? The environmental issues. How can this environmental crisis be dealt with on a class basis? And, of course, all the other more obvious issues, well, they're all obvious, but issues like wages, jobs, poverty, the amazing inequality of distribution of wealth, all these things then would start to be debated in the public arena more. And I think that is a very important part of any struggle to deal with capitalist society.
Okay, Bill?
John, I like to say that what you have just said has been a lot of wisdom. And my take on it is, number one, you mentioned organizing fast food workers. Well, I think that the labor movement in the United States really fell down decades ago when they allowed when the RWDSU, I think would be it, or also the food and commercial workers would be involved in this stuff, allowed stores like Kmart to proliferate and places like McDonald's and not tried to organize them. I also think the AFL-CIO really fell down by not organizing the South.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first place where the union good-paying jobs fled. They fled to the South first.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the foreign car companies go first, is the South, because it's a non-union area. But the thing that I think is most important that you were talking about in the more general is getting together with other workers, be they union, non-union, and not just on workplace issues. And I think the key to that, and people who listen to this show have heard me harp on this, and people who have been to meetings where I've been have heard me harp on this, we got to get out into the neighborhoods, into the communities. We have to go knock on doors. I know that unions do that during organizing campaigns where they need to find out people, you know, that's the only way they can reach people to workplace. And politicians do that.
Mm-hmm.
We need to do that. And we, even if we get rejected so many times, we will find a person somewhere in that community, in that neighborhood, who is in workplaces and various social networks who will become interested and involved. And I think that you are very right. We shouldn't just be saving foreclosed people. We should be helping save them first and give them a tool to work with to fight the whole, basically the whole economic crimes that have been committed against the entire society below the 1%.
Right. But the thing is, we shouldn't be saving foreclosed people. We should be helping foreclosed people save themselves.
Yes, to actually engage them.
That's actually what I was trying to say.
Yeah,
right.
But
to engage them
at the same time.
Yes,
that's right.
John, we're just about out of time here. Any final thoughts and any kind of information you'd like to leave us with as far as contact information or places people could go?
Well, if anybody's interested and has any comments to me personally, I welcome them to send me an email at 1999wildcat@gmail.com. That's 1999wildcat@gmail.com. And you, as you know, or you may know, you know, the Occupy movement is now planning to send a caravan up to Longview, Washington, where there's basically a scab grain terminal being run. They're scabbing on the Longshoremen's Union.
Mm-hmm.
It's really criminal. What's happened is that the leadership of the operating engineers is having their own members scab on the Longshoremen's Union, and there's going to be an attempt to shut that terminal down. Once again, there, I think that, you know, it's good for the Occupy movement to be doing that, but we also have to make a demand on the union leadership that they step up to the plate.
Yes, yes.
And because you're going to need 10, 20, 30,000 people up there to be successful.
And, unless
the Occupy movement can get that many people up there by themselves, then we need to call on those who have the power to actually do it.
When's that expected to happen, John?
We don't know. It's going to be sometime in January or February, whenever the ship comes in.
Okay. All right, John. Very good. Thank you so much for calling in, and we'll keep you posted, listeners. John's always got some great reports that he puts online and stuff, and we'll be reading them occasionally here on the Illinois World Labor Hour. John, thanks.
Oh, and yes. One last thing. We have a website, worldwidesocialist.net/blog. That's worldwidesocialist.net/blog. Thanks a lot, Dave, and Revolutionary New Year to you.
Okay, likewise, John. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Keep up the good work, John.
Okay, we now come to that point in the Labor Hour with Tom Thomas's new poem of the week that he wrote just for this show today. It's called Together, Shore to Shore.
Another year is ending now that had some bad days and some good. It was a year when citizens for cherished rights together stood. It was a year of recession, though not as bad as some before. It was a year of concession in ending one illegal war. The curse of Bush brought recession. We've suffered more than 30 years, and we still have illegal wars with tragedies that bring us tears. 11 was a year to grow, and that was what so many did. We grew broker and hungrier. From us our nation's promise hid. We victims are identified. We are the 99%. We worked our fingers to the bone, not knowing where our taxes went. The 1% are greedy pigs who care for nothing but their wealth. And when the people stand in march, it is not for the banker's help. This new year that is coming up, we need to march a whole lot more to let the politicians know we are together, shore to shore. We were born a rebel nation, as with tyranny we did cope. And if we're all standing together, this new year ahead will bring hope. Together, Shore to Shore was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on December 29th, 2011. And was brought to you live today, December 31st, 2011, New Year's Eve, here on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. And just to remind all the listeners, check out Laborers Worldview Television on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6, this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. Okay, Bill?
Yeah, I got more of an announcement here. This is a story passed on to me by retired laborer, actually, Ed Rodden. And anyway, this is something, if you need a job, I would suggest that you go to the News Gazette website, if possible, or pick up today's newspaper. I think it would be in there, or perhaps yesterday's. And what this is about is the pre-apprenticeship program held at Parkland College for the building trades.
Okay.
That is sponsored, actually, by the Department of Transportation.
Oh, interesting.
And okay. Even though they're talking about, even though it's called the Highway Construction Careers Training Program, they talk in here about how people have gone on from this program to get, say, into the Electricians Union.
Okay.
As apprentices. And anyway, it begins the week of January 9th, and the classes... orientation for the program held at Parkland College will begin the week of January 9th. And classes will start the week of February 13th and run for 10 weeks. And so if you know somebody who needs work and who wants to get a opportunity at something that you should consider a career more than just a job, please try and find out more about this. Now, 56 people have graduated from this program since it began in September 2010. Only 11 have received placements in apprentice programs, but that is because of what happened in 2009 with the destruction almost of the local construction industry. However, things have been picking up, and I have been working with more and more laborer apprentices in recent weeks. In fact, about 3 months ago, I worked with a guy. It was his first day ever on a job.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, guys, we kind of ran out of time today, but any last comments, any last stories that weren't mentioned about the year? We didn't do justice to it, really. We really needed a two-hour program, I guess. But nevertheless, guys, any last comments or whatever?
One thing I did want to mention, and we did devote a good deal of time during the year to this issue that was thankfully fairly well resolved for them, is the successful resolution of the 13-month lockout in Metropolis, Illinois.
Yes.
The workers at Honeywell, who had really, just to briefly recap it, undergone an awful lot. There were 228 locked-out workers who they ended up getting slight pay raises, but they were not permanently replaced. And it was such an important issue, I think, for two reasons that I highlight. One, because of the enormous amount of safety issues in the plant, but also environmentally in the community, that you had OSHA cite Honeywell 17 times for serious violations. You had Honeywell violate the Resource Conservation Recovery Act for allowing 7,500 drums of illegally stored radioactive mud to be leaking into the Ohio River. And you had also the other important point was it was such a good case of good local activism, and they received a lot of support, but received no real support from Democrats and also from Obama and others who were hosting Honeywell CEO David Cote and bringing him on trips in different places. And there's no good reason why the Democrats, and especially the steelworkers nationally, were not hammering away at this issue, especially given its enormous implications. So in many ways, in spite of, instead rather than because of, union leadership and Democratic leadership allegedly acting for labor, these workers ended up winning this lockout. It was a huge victory.
Bob?
Yeah, Dave, in June, the largest class action discrimination lawsuit in the nation's history involved Walmart, and that was decided by the Supreme Court.
Okay.
It says that in rejecting the lawsuit, the Supreme Court found that the plaintiffs, who had sought back pay for as many as 1.5 million women nationwide, had failed to establish that the legal and factual issues involving all those women had enough in common to be examined as a single class. In other words, the Supreme Court didn't determine whether Walmart had discriminated against the women or not. They simply concluded that they didn't have enough in common to be filed as one class action lawsuit.
A technicality.
But 4 months later, in October, the Supreme Court, there's a new lawsuit now that's going to involve just 90,000 women currently and formerly employed at Walmart's and Sam's Club stores in four regions in California. So they're going to continue seeking these discrimination charges against Walmart. And
good.
Someday they'll be somewhat successful.
Okay. And Bill?
And this is more of a trend than an event, but that is the condemnation of capitalism and the rehabilitation of socialism in our culture. And there was a recent Pew poll where 49% of people 18 to 29 have a positive view of socialism, and only 43% say they have a negative view. That similar idea, there was similar support for socialism among African Americans and among what were called liberal Democrats in the polls.
And that's despite the fact that socialism, just the definition of the word, can ask 10 people and you'll get at least 9 different definitions.
Well, that's because there are perhaps hundreds of different kinds of socialism, just as there is anarchism.
Yes, Bob.
And another issue, the trade agreements that went through this year in October. President Obama pushed them through.
Now, I remember Obama on the campaign.